CataractCoach.com podcast series episode number 149 with Dr. Sonia Yu from Bascom Palmer, surgical planning for corneal and lenticular refractive procedures.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest. That is my dear friend, Dr. Sonia Yu from the Bascom Palmer Institute. Sonia, welcome to our podcast.
Hi, how are you, Uday? Thanks for having me.
For sure. I mean, gosh, we've known each other for, I hate to tell anyone, certainly more than 20 years.
Yeah, if you're counting.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're obviously always at the forefront or being a pioneer, basically, in the refractive surgery space. And so what people sometimes don't realize now that refractive surgery is so common, when you and I finished our training, let's say in the late 90s or early 2000, it was nothing. It was very little. It was just getting started.
That's right. People were still interested in my cornea fellowship and keratoprostheses, and you know, ocular surface has always been a hot topic and a big unmet need. And refractive surgery was really in its infancy. I remember as a medical student doing research on PRK, and this was something that was brand new in the United States.
Right. I didn't. How funny is that? So did I. When I was a med student, I was at USC, and Peter McDonald was junior faculty, who's now chairman at Wilmer. And we did a study of unrabbits to see how, after PRK, which drugs would influence closure of the epithelium.
Exactly. I mean, it sounds very similar to the things that we were looking at in Cleveland. And here we are so many years later. And it's exciting to have seen all these different advancements in refractive surgery. It's really incredible.
Now, when you did your cornea fellowship, you probably didn't do a whole lot of corneal refractive surgery in it.
Not LASIK, because LASIK really hadn't taken off in Boston at that time. We were starting to do PRK, and we actually did a fair amount of PRK during fellowship, but LASIK was something that was really new, and I was learning LASIK as an early attending, really.
Right. So
that's one of the exciting things about refractive surgery is, as the technology evolves, you know, you're constantly learning new things even throughout your entire career.
Right. Now, what pearls do you have? Our podcast gets a lot of young ophthalmologists, and they're always asking, well, how do you learn a new technique or a new technology? You're already in practice and this new device comes along. Well, how do you learn it?
Yeah. I think that, you know, in ophthalmology, because it's very technology heavy, we have to be prepared to always adapt and learn new things. Usually ophthalmology draws people that are interested in technology. And so I think it's not a big leap for us to embrace new technology within our, within our job setting. I think reaching out to mentors is a good start. There are also courses, hands-on courses that you can take advantage of, either through the device companies or through memberships like the American Academy of Ophthalmology or ASCRS, or even some international memberships like the ISRS, where you can go and take advantage of, you know, the different wet labs that are going on. And again, some of the technologies advance earlier in other countries, so we can draw upon our colleagues outside of the United States to help us learn.
Right. I definitely agree with you there, especially the part about the ISRS. If you're a young ophthalmologist, the ISRS is International Society for Refractive Surgery. Sonia and I are both members. I definitely encourage you to join. It's a great way to kind of keep up to date. Now, you've changed everything you do over the last, let's say, 20 years. So what you do now for corneal refractive surgery is not what you did 20 years ago.
It's entirely different. I mean, the lasers are different. The way we make flaps is entirely different. And it's interesting because, you know, again, when there's new technologies that are introduced, sometimes they're a boom and sometimes they're a bust. So
right.
Part of the adaptation of new technology is trying to vet and see, is this really better and safer than what we're doing currently? And sometimes that's tightrope to walk. But again, that's why we can draw upon our colleagues within the ophthalmology community and have sort of open and honest discussions about you know, what the benefits are and what the potential drawbacks are of something new that's being introduced in our field.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. The market always plays it out. Like, we've had treatments for presbyopia that would increase corneal curvature, such as Sunrise LTK. You remember that one? Or conductive keratoplasty. Did you try those? If you can, just tell us your experience. And
yeah, absolutely. You know, the LTK, laser thermokeratoplasty, and CK, conductive keratoplasty, were basically heat applied to the corneal stroma to shrink the collagen to get the kind of steepening that you want for the correction of presbyopia or low hyperopia. And it actually was pretty effective. However, it wasn't a long-lasting effect. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you would get regression of your treatment. And sometimes, because the initial iterations of the technology were less automated, you might be more prone to having some induced irregular astigmatism. But, you know, we learn a lot from the new technology. So sometimes, you know, version one isn't the best version, but we learn a lot. And sometimes we even find that there's a different, better application for technology that's introduced. For example, the femtosecond laser. When the femtosecond laser was introduced in ophthalmology, it was actually for retina. The research was done in retina. And lo and behold, they found out that, oh, wow, look, the femtosecond laser can be used to create a dissection plane in the cornea. And then, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah. Even the eczema laser was first used to, like, etch computer chips, right? And then they figured out, oh, it's 193 nanometers. It's ultraviolet. Hey, maybe we can etch the cornea.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I think that it's good to keep an open mind and a creative mind, because you can start to think about how you can use the technologies in a better way, or not only to improve it, but, you know, for other applications. And that goes for technologies that are introduced not only within ophthalmology, but outside of ophthalmology too.
For sure. Yeah, a common concern I get from young ophthalmologists or resident ophthalmologists through cataract coach, which is very popular among the younger ophthalmologists, is that, well, what if I don't learn this in residency? What do I do there?
Right.
Well, you're going to have to teach yourself.
That's right. And you won't learn everything in your residency or fellowship that you're going to need to use within your career. Again, it's ever evolving. And so you just need to, you know, keep current, stay update on your reading, your studies, attend meetings, attend podcasts like yours. Sure. To find out what's new and exciting, and then reach out to your mentors and your colleagues to help you in the transition of learning the new techniques.
For sure. I think it's a great way of looking at it. Now, and you're a faculty at Bascom Palmer, and you obviously have amazing residents. It's one of the probably the best ophthalmology program in the U.S. and certainly one of the best residencies. You're a faculty at Bascom Palmer, so you're definitely teaching residents and fellows. And do you teach them refractive surgery as well?
Yeah, our residents have some opportunities to come into the refractive surgery suite. We usually do a wet lab in the summer and get people certified on the laser platforms that we have for the residents that are interested. And then they have the opportunity to treat some of their patients throughout the year. And all of our fellows, our cornea fellows, of course, are in there regularly getting certified and treating the patients. With the residents, they have the opportunity, but, you know, again, some of the residents seize the opportunity and other residents are maybe interested in other areas.
Yeah, plastics or retina or something else for sure.
Right.
For sure. What do you think is coming down the road for treatment of presbyopia? Because that's probably our biggest unmet need, is treatment of presbyopia. LTK, yeah. CK, all these things were for presbyopia. What are you doing now for presbyopia? And what do you think is coming down the road?
Well, presbyopia is the big holy grail, because it affects everybody. And it's very exciting because we have corneal treatments for presbyopia, different kind of ablations with LASIK that can be used to create somewhat of a multifocal cornea to help with presbyopia. We also have intraocular lenses where the technology is getting better and better each year. We see different extended depth of focus lenses and multifocal lenses being introduced to the market that are helping to, you know, really solve this issue. And then we have medications. We have different types of eye drops that are affecting the pupil and the muscles in the eye to help address presbyopia as well. So I think that we've got multiple ways to treat this problem that will affect everybody at some point in their life. And it's a very exciting time.
So if I can give you a few examples, what would you do in these situations? Let's say an easy one, a 30-year-old minus two myope comes in, wants refractive surgery. What's kind of your go-to?
Well, that's the easiest one, as you said. You know, patients are really happy. Young patients who have low myopia are really happy with laser refractive surgery. I would offer the patient PRK or LASIK, depending on their lifestyle, depending on their exam and their candidacy. So for me, 30-year-old low myope would be a perfect laser vision correction candidate.
Right. I agree with you there. And so basically Plano OU.
Yeah. Targeting distance.
Now, what about a 40-year-old? The same minus two myope, but now 40 years old. So not quite presbyopic yet, but we know what the future is.
Yeah. So 40-year-old, I still like laser vision correction for a 40-year-old low myope. You may discuss with them the impending presbyopia that they're going to have. And in that case, I might offer them a little mini monovision, targeting maybe a minus a half or even minus three quarters in their non-dominant eye.
That's a smart way of doing it, for sure. Now, how about the 50-year-old? This is a tough one. The 50-year-old who's minus two, starting to be presbyopic, and the patient says, listen, my near vision is fantastic. Just fix my distance vision. Now what do you
do? Yeah, that's pretty much every 50-year-old myope. And, you know, I in that case, again, if I identify them as a good candidate for laser refractive surgery, I would discuss monovision with them. I would try out monovision with that patient in a contact lens trial to see if they would be able to adapt to it. And, you know, for me, a 50-year-old low myope for a lens surgery, like a clear lens refraction, is a little trickier decision. Usually their vitreous is still formed. They may not yet have a PVD. And so you worry about, you know, retinal issues with refractive lens exchange. So I still, for that patient, would prefer laser vision correction. And I would try to spend some time with them seeing if they would be able to adapt to monovision.
Now, what about that same 50-year-old who's a plus two?
Yeah. A plus two, again, could be a candidate for monovision with laser vision correction. They actually might do better with a refractive lens exchange. You're still concerned about whether the vitreous is intact, if they've had a PVD. I think it's a good idea to look and see. But for hyperopes, because they're, you know, at less risk of retinal tears or detachment, I think that that 50-year-old hyperope who can't get used to monovision, who doesn't want to wear glasses for distance or reading, could then you could start to talk about maybe an intraocular lens surgery.
Sure. And how much hyperopia are you willing to treat with corneal refractive surgery like LASIK?
Yeah. My limit is about plus 350. Sometimes I'll go up to plus four. So, you know, as you get higher into the treatments for hyperopia, you tend to have a little degradation of the quality of vision. So I usually like to stop at about plus 350 or maybe plus four.
Yeah, I'm with you. I even these days have my limit lower, even like plus 250, maybe plus three at the most. For our young ophthalmologists, remember that taking away part of the cornea is easy. It's easy to flatten a cornea and with a nice big optical zone. To steepen a cornea, either your eczema is doing basically like a donut-shaped ablation.
Exactly. And you start to have sort of weird tear breakup on the surface, and with older patients, they may have marginal tear film anyway. So I think it gets to be a little trickier with a higher hyperopic treatments in little older patients.
Now let's continue our series here. A 60-year-old who's a minus two, what would you do?
Yeah, 60-year-old minus two, again, I don't personally have a limit on age in terms of laser vision correction. The reason why I really like laser vision correction is if you look at the statistics, the outcomes in terms of percentage of being 20/20 without glasses after surgery, laser vision correction still beats intraocular lens surgery all day, every day. Mm-hmm. So in terms of being able to hit your refractive target, you're much more successful with laser vision correction. Now, a 60-year-old has some other issues. They may not have a great tear film, so you need to really identify and study their ocular surface. And that might preclude them from having laser vision correction. They might have an early cataract. So these are types of things that you really need to assess. And there's certain diagnostic tools that you can use to try to help you identify the quality or the aberrations on the cornea and the aberrations inside of the eye that occur from the lens to help you get an idea other than just observing and looking at the slit lamp. We have now diagnostic tools that can help us sort out, whether they have a good cornea and a clear lens or whether there's, a little dry eye and a little cataract that's forming.
And then the 60-year-old plus two hyperope, that you're probably going to do lens surgery, right?
Yeah, you got it. 60-year-old plus two hyperope, I would be talking about intraocular lens surgery.
Right. And so how do you tell a patient or explain to them that there's a little bit of a compromise here, let's say a trifocal or multifocal lens? What's your kind of, what's your script for the patient?
Yeah, I think that with a multifocal lens, the vision is good at all distances, but maybe not great at all distances.
That's a nice way of putting it.
So, I think that it depends on the patient's priorities. I have some patients that come and tell me, I will not wear glasses under any circumstances. I do not want to wear glasses. I ask them about their hobbies and their occupation. Are they doing a lot of night driving? Are they is their occupation dependent upon driving at nighttime? Are they the designated driver for their household? I try to get an idea of their lifestyle and their visual needs and really what their main motivations are. Sometimes they'll start a conversation with the patient. They'll say, I don't want to wear glasses for distance or near. And then you start to talk to them and they say, oh yeah, but wearing some little over-the-counter glasses for reading small print is fine. Yeah. So it's worthwhile to take an extra few minutes to talk to them to really see like what they would be willing to tolerate and what their priorities are.
Right. One of my favorites is I'll tell the patient, well, this is a great lens. It'll give you 20/25 distance vision and 20/25 intermediate and 20/20 near. And if they're like, yeah, that sounds great, I'm happy. If they say, whoa, well, why not 20/20? And I'm like, okay, I gotcha.
Right. Good screening question.
I think that's probably because, if we truly had a beautiful, truly accommodating eye well that gave 4 or 5 diopters of accommodation, well, gosh, we don't have to explain anything.
Right. And that's ultimately where we're trying to go is for true accommodative lens or lens material. And we're not quite there yet. We have some great options. So that's what's really exciting about our field right now. But there's room for improvement.
Oh, absolutely. Right. I mean, once we hit that holy grail of a truly accommodating lens, I think that's like the only lens I'm going to be using.
Right. You got it.
Than one for my own eye.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a tough one. But hopefully it'll come soon. Are you doing any presbyopic laser treatments like presby LASIK? So any corneal presbyopia? I don't. I just do a little monovision.
Yeah. We're not doing presbyon or we're not doing presby LASIK at our center. We are doing monovision, sometimes mini monovision, which works really well. for a lot of patients. But we're not doing sort of variable ablations for presbyopia.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. It's very uncommon here in the U.S. And then I noticed our colleagues, our fellow ophthalmologists who've had laser vision correction, they just do straight monovision. Monovision is so common among ophthalmologists in their own eyes, even for whether pseudophakic or with the refractive surgery.
That's right. I mean, monovision works great. It's just that for some people, it takes them longer to accommodate to monovision. And it probably has something to do with the strength of your ocular dominance. And you know, there is cross ocular dominance as well. And for people who cross have that, maybe it's a little more difficult to get used to monovision. I find people who are very strongly one eye dominant seem to tolerate monovision much better.
Yeah, I have a tough time with it. I'm minus two spherical both eyes. And luckily, and obviously solidly presbyopic. And so I'm super happy. I end up just doing indoors. I just go without glasses.
Yeah.
I'll tolerate the blur.
That's sort of an ideal, you know, refractive correction for an ophthalmologist who's, you know, over 50.
Right. But I've tried the contact in one eye versus the other eye. I've tried it both ways. After a while, I just don't like it. It's just too
That's
much,
so
it's,
interesting.
I mean, it's too much of a compromise. I've tried it for months. Because I tell patients, if I do their monovision, I said, you have to wait 3 months before you complain.
Mm-hmm. And out of curiosity, what is your ocular dominance? Are you very strongly ocular dominant in one eye? Do you sometimes cross or?
Probably. I'm not super strongly dominant in one eye or the other. Probably I'm a little bit cross-wired in the brain. I started off as a left-handed kid. Uh-huh. My parents would make me switch because they said, like, a good boy can't be left-handed. So I had to be right-handed at home and left-handed at school.
Interesting.
So I'm a little bit crazy in the head. Well, you know that. So yeah, I don't mind switching back and forth. Even to the day, I can still write with both hands.
That's interesting because I wonder if the strength of your ocular dominance has to do with your ability to adjust to monovision. It's just an idea that I have, but I do monovision. I'm very strongly right eye dominant, and it's no problem at all for me to adjust to monovision.
Now, is there truth to the thing that people say, well, the dominant eye should be distance, or can you flip the other way?
It depends. Usually, conventionally, we do the dominant eye for distance. However, I would say there's some occupations or some hobbies where, you know, people spend a lot of time on near, and that's sort of their priority. In those cases, you can flip their ocular dominance. And studies have shown that people can get adjusted to switching and having their non-dominant eye be their distance eye, but probably depends upon your activities, you know, your visual needs.
Right. Yeah, that's probably the most important thing is, as you said, tailor it to the patient. If they're a night driver, you're driving a truck at nighttime every day. Well, you should probably choose a monofocal and hit Plano.
Right. And, you know, I have cases where a patient will come to me and they've been wearing their contact lenses, monovision, but they've been using their non-dominant eye for distance. Mm-hmm. And I don't try to switch them. When we're talking about surgery and keeping monovision, I don't try to switch them, say, no, your dominant eye should be for distance. I just go with what they're used to, what their brain is used to, and don't try to switch, you know, the convention.
Yeah, that's an important concept that was not taught to me in residency or my training, is that the brain likes what the brain likes.
Even
patients like me, who I'm a low myope, gosh, if I overcorrect to plus a quarter of my glasses, I hate it. But if you undercorrect me to minus a quarter, I'm happy.
And I found the same thing as, you know, I hit my presbyopia years. If I'm slightly overcorrected, it drives me mad. So I even in my distance eye, I slightly undercorrect. I just feel more comfortable. I feel more functional. And maybe that's the way you've become accustomed as a myope of sort of being used to maybe not everything being crystal clear at distance. You know, you've made some, your brain has made some compromises for your distance vision your entire life. But you're not used to compromising your near vision. As a
myopia on the brain a little bit.
Exactly. That's good.
You know, the hyperopia, I had a patient recently where she's a high hyperope, let's say maybe plus 8 or something, and wearing glasses, and I do her eyewall surgery and hit monofocal lenses, which is what she wanted. The one eye ends up plus 0.5 and one eye ends up minus 0.5. And she hates the minus 0.5 eye. I'm like, why? But it has better, like, in me. She just, she has like hyperopia in the brain.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting. It's so interesting. I mean, I think that people's brain are also somewhat elastic that over time, or plastic that over time you could get adjusted to it. But you're absolutely right. Is that that's why it's so important. And when residents come and present me a case or my fellows, I'm always asking, okay, what's the age of the patient? You have to present me the age of the patient. What's their refractive error? I want to know their refractive error because I want to know what their baseline is, what they're used to. And that gives me an idea of what their baseline uncorrected vision is, not only for distance, but for near as well. Because, you know, as a refractive surgeon, I'm talking about corneal refractive or intraocular refractive surgery, you need to beat their baseline. So ophthalmologists think in best corrected vision. Patients think about uncorrected vision. They're thinking of what can I see without glasses now? And it better be better after surgery. And that's not only for distance, but for near as well. So that's why treating a myope is particularly challenging because you may improve their distance vision, but if you make their near vision worse than what they were used to before surgery, that requires a long discussion with the patient so that they're prepared for that loss. And I'll tell you, for a presbyopic myope, losing that near uncorrected near vision is a loss.
No, for sure. For sure. That's a tough one. The other one I was surprised by, the same patient who was a plus 8 hyper, wore glasses, after becoming pseudophakic, said, yeah, I'm happy, but now everything looks smaller. She was used to the magnification of the plus 8 glasses.
Yeah, that happens too. And then sometimes you find out, you know, the patient had a little refractive amblyopia. That happens too in higher hyperopes that are used to wearing big, you know, hyperopic glasses that gave them some magnification. And lo and behold, you do surgery and they have a little bit of loss, maybe a line loss of their best corrected vision. You're saying, what is this? What's going on? Everything is perfect. Their eye looks perfect. But sometimes those high hyperopes actually have a little refractive amblyopia that you didn't recognize because they got the magnification from their glasses, from their spectacles.
Yeah, I've learned that one the hard way too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how about this one? I had a patient recently and I didn't know what to do. Plano minus 2 and 180, both eyes. Goes around all day without glasses. So to be a good resident here, 65 years old, wants some sort of refractive procedure. Plano minus 2 and 180 in both eyes. Doesn't wear glasses because she got two focal points, Plano and one meridian and minus 2 at the other.
So right.
Like, I don't know what to do.
Right. So with the rule of astigmatism is also really helpful for presbyopic patients. And sometimes when we're choosing targets, let's say we're deciding to put a toric lens. Do I put a toric lens in, or I'm in between two toric powers, T3 or T4, right. Which way do I go? That we try to target, if we have to, on one side or the other with the rule. Why? With the rule for two reasons. Number one, the reason that you're bringing up, that the with the rule astigmatism can help with the near vision. And number two, that over time, the natural drift of patients is to go from with the rule to against the rule. Mm. So with time, you may have a little bit of shift from with to against. And so we like a little with the rule astigmatism, if there's any astigmatism at all. In the case of your patient where the 60-year-old isn't wearing glasses at all, I would say maybe they're not ready for surgery yet.
That's what I said.
Yeah, exactly. So in those cases where, you know, you say, gosh, this is going to be hard to beat where they are, maybe just wait until you feel confident that what you're going to do for the patient is going to beat what they have.
Hey, that's the point. To really hammer that home that, yeah, what the patients can bring, that uncorrected vision, which they're used to. They're used to the blurred all ranges, but they have such a wide range. If I do an IOL and put a toric lens in and bring that patient to plano, I'm going to collapse that depth of field for the patient.
That's right.
So I actually asked the patient, what's the one thing you'd love me to fix for your vision? She says, well, I'm happy all day. It's just, I just need to see better for driving at night. We gave her a pair of driving glasses for nighttime, and she's happy and I'm happy.
Yeah. Yeah, I do that too. Sometimes I just say, you know what? You're in a great situation. You are where we would target some of our refractive patients. Yeah. So just here, keep your glasses in the car. Use them when you need them.
Yeah, for sure. Can we switch gears and talk a little bit about faking? I'm taking notes here. I'm learning from you. can we talk about faking IOLs?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, on the approval, it says ages 18 to 45. When and do you go above age 45, if ever?
Yeah, I think that, I certainly have gone over the age of 45. The reason for 45 is that the advantage of keeping your lens in is one, that you maintain your ability to accommodate. So it takes advantage of having a young lens that can accommodate and then having the phakic IOL on top of the lens. Now, we have some patients that are very high myopes that, again, have not yet had a PVD, who, if you decide to do refractive lens exchange, are at high risk for retinal tear or detachment. There have been a couple large studies that have been published this year, or I guess last year now, in 2025, that have shown that the rate of retinal detachment in patients that do not yet have a PVD, that are high myopes having refractive lens exchange, is actually quite significant. So let's say you have somebody who's a minus 12 male. Male's a risk factor too. Minus 12 male, 48-year-old that comes in wanting refractive surgery. That might be a patient that you would offer ICL in over refractive lens exchange because you want to, keep their lens in and sort of disturb the vitreous as least as you can.
Right. Because, you got to think, you've got this 4 millimeter thick crystalline lens, which you're taking out. You're putting this tiny 1 millimeter thin IOL. That 3 millimeter gap is going to be filled in by shifting vitreous. And without a PVD, you may be putting a lot of traction on that already stretched out retina.
Right. And it's actually a significant risk of having a retinal detachment in that scenario. If it's somebody that's not a high myope, then you may have a different discussion with the patient, or certainly if the patient has already, had a PVD, their risk is lower.
Right. And I think we have such a higher incidence of myopia these days compared to previous generations. And it's like almost getting to be like epidemic levels of myopia.
Right. Well, I guess with all the screen time, it's beneficial for that.
Right. The problem is, these young kids end up being, let's say, a little minus one or minus two because all the time on the screen, and then we put them in contacts or glasses, make them plano, and then they become more myopic. And so I've actually really admire all the stuff that the pediatric ophthalmologists are doing with myopia control.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's interesting of using pharmacology to help with myopia control. I think as time goes on, we're going to see newer medications that develop that'll help sort of control the accommodation without having some of the side effects. So I'm looking forward to that.
When I was earlier in my career, I thought, kind of naively so, that doing refractive surgery would be like braces. Every kid gets braces on their teeth when they're like 10 or 12 years old. So they have nice, pretty straight teeth. And then I thought, okay, they never do the same. By the time they finish college or college graduation present, it's going to be refractive surgery. But yet, like the rate of refractive surgery in the U.S. kind of hasn't increased like that. It's kind of been stagnant. Why?
Yeah, I think that I'm not sure it's entirely stagnant. Over our careers, we've seen a shift in how refractive surgery is delivered. I would say at the beginning, if you know, 30 years ago, we were doing a lot of corneal laser refractive and very, very little refractive intraocular surgery. Yeah. And I would say, you know, over time, as the technology has improved with intraocular lenses, we've maybe cannibalized some of our laser refractive cases into our lens-based surgery practice, because those 50-year-olds that have refractive error are now getting shifted more towards intraocular lens surgery, whereas before that wasn't even an option because we didn't have presbyopic lenses available. So I think that's part of it, that we're seeing a shift. And if you look at the volume of refractive lens surgery, it's exploded, right, and it's continuing to grow. So that, I would say, it's not a drop in refractive surgery. It's a shift in how we're performing the refractive surgery. For the younger patients, I still think a lot of younger patients are having corneal laser refractive surgery. Maybe the press and social media has created some, you know, fear about corneal laser refractive surgery. But, you know, I think it's up to us as professionals, people like you, Uday, who have a, you know, large presence on social media, to help inform people and help to allay some of those fears about, you know, laser surgery, particularly for younger patients.
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest challenge, that there's a fear about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, as ophthalmologists that are doing all different types of surgeries, really laser vision correction is one of the most reliable, safest surgeries with the quickest visual rehabilitation that we offer. So I think if you look at in that respect, in that framework, you know, it should be something that younger people adopt more easily. But again, you know, in the age of social media, it's hard to sort of negate some of the small bad press that's out there, because it gives a small group of patients a very, very large, loud voice.
Yeah, and it gets sensationalized.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for other reason, people don't mind doing a face transplant for plastic surgery, but their eyeballs, don't touch my eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, you know, it's our job, I think, to try to allay some of the fears about refractive surgery, and, you know, try to bring the truth, you know, to our audience.
Yeah, I think there were studies that show that ophthalmologists have a higher rate of doing refractive surgery on their eyes than the general population.
Right. That's interesting. That's interesting. I didn't know that. I guess I'm not surprised, but it's also familiarity with the procedure.
No, for sure. And I think you've also brought a good point where you've kind of half to the whole spectrum. 20 years ago, if you wanted to be a refractive surgeon, it meant you're doing corneal refractive surgery, basically. That's it. But now with our new technologies, you've got to do the whole spectrum. Cornea, phakic lens, IOL, the works.
That's right. And, you know, particularly, you know, cataract surgeons, where the bar has now been set so high in terms of patient expectations, you need a strategy to be able to deal with the refractive surprises. And, you know, by refractive surprises, I'm not talking about being 2 diopters off of the target. You know, sometimes the patients, they've got, you know, 3/4 of a diopter of residual cylinder that you didn't expect. And, you know, they want to be fixed.
Right.
So it's very helpful if you have in your armamentarium the ability to do laser vision correction. It saves the patient from having to go back to surgery, I mean, to the main OR, and, you know, potentially allows you to you know, give them the fix that they're looking for with a you know, reasonably short rehabilitation period.
Right. Yeah, I had a patient yesterday where I had to do LASIK to touch up a refractive error. And as you said, sometimes, especially with these newer technology lenses, they're just not tolerant of being off by just a little bit even.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, the bar is really high. The bar is really high because the lenses are great, but, you know, again, if you look at the data showing the outcomes, like what's the chance that you're going to be within plus or minus a half of your refractive target after IOL surgery? Maybe it's 85%, maybe it's 90%, but that still means 10% are outside of that plus or minus a half. And for a corneal laser refractive surgeon, that's not good. 10% outside of plus or minus a half of intended target is, that's not good. So you need to be able, as a intraocular refractive surgeon, you need to be able to handle those 10% of patients, those 10% of eyes that are outside of your target.
Now, we're clearly not doing LASIK enhancements or PRK enhancements on 10% of IOL patients. So how do you determine which patient will really need it and which one is fine as is?
Well, you know, it again, patients with multifocal IOLs tolerate residual astigmatism less well than patients who have EDOFs or monofocal lenses. So that's something to counsel if you're going to put in a multifocal lens implant, something to talk about the patient beforehand. If you have some residual astigmatism, we may need to do an enhancement procedure for that. For patients who end up a little myopic, they tend to tolerate it better than patients who end up a little hyperopic. That's why when you choose your IOL power, ophthalmologists tend to, in some cases, hedge towards a little bit of myopia, because you don't want a hyperopic surprise for most lens implants. There's some exceptions to that with lens technology. So, you know, it depends on the lens that you're using. It depends upon the patient and, again, where they're starting and where they end up. So if they start really bad, let's say high hyperope, can't see without glasses far or near, those are easier patients to make happy than the 60-year-old minus two patients.
Yeah, that's such a good point about the before and after. What was the patient used to uncorrected before, and now what do they have after? And if that's a big delta, a big improvement, they're just happy. They're not expecting perfection.
Yeah, I mean, that may be better than what they ever were used to before, you know, even with glasses.
Right.
Especially if they have a cataract. So, you know, I think that's really important to keep in mind, you know, where they are, where they're going to be afterwards, and to be, you know, really confident that you're going to be able to hit that goal, even if it means doing a few procedures, lens surgery, and then maybe a laser enhancement.
So basically finish the job.
Finish the job. Don't create anxiety in the patient's mind. Say, we've got this plan to get you where we want to get you. So you don't need to freak out if after your lens surgery, you have some residual astigmatism. We have a plan to take care of that.
Now, what do you say to the patient when the patient says to you, "Doctor, well, how come I ended up like this? Did you put the wrong lens in my eye?"
Yeah, I mean, again, I tell patients, we're dealing with a human eye. We're dealing with wound healing. It's not that we're, you know, putting a piece of plastic in a robot and every robot's the same, right? So there's some things that we can control, but there are some things that we can't control. We can't control the wound healing in each individual patient. We use algorithms that take many, many, many patients and, you know, create a formula that's going to work for the vast majority of patients, but there are some outliers.
Yeah, for sure. I tell the patients that, listen, we planned it out beautifully. Here's the math. The math is spot on. You didn't heal as well as we wanted you to, but don't worry. Even though you're a bad healer, I can do this laser procedure and get your vision sharp. Hang in there.
Right, exactly. You know, the other thing is that the ocular surface evaluation is really, really important. It's very important preoperatively, not only for the lens surgery, if you're doing lens surgery, but also to think about, is this patient going to be a candidate for laser vision correction afterwards if they need it? And am I doing a procedure that's going to put them at higher chance that they're going to need a laser touch-up? So, for example, you have somebody who's a bit dry drier on the surface, an older woman that's coming in for lens surgery, and you're thinking about, am I going to put a multifocal lens in this patient or not? Things that go through my mind are, you know, are they going to even be a candidate for a laser touch-up if they need it? Mm-hmm. So it's really important to sort of be a good chess player, like think right. a few steps ahead so that you can strategize about what you're going to do if things aren't perfect, because it's not always going to be perfect.
Right. I think the data that I saw was that for laser refractive surgery, like 96 or more percent of patients are within a half diopter target. Whereas for IOL surgery, the typical in the US is about 80%.
Yeah.
And even those really meticulous surgeons who track all their data, et cetera, they're still at best 90-ish.
Right.
That's a significant gap. We're not just there yet.
Right. We're far from there yet. And so that's, I guess, the appeal of technologies like light adjustable lens, where you can, you know, titrate the outcome after you've done the surgery. And that's sort of part of the sell of that lens technology. You know, again, it would be nice if it didn't require as many postoperative visits back. That's sort of what I like about corneal laser vision correction, is that, you know, you get the refraction, then you treat it.
It's done. Boom.
And it's done. Right. And it's done. But, you know, there's certain, I think, advantages to not touching the cornea. You know, let's say a patient who's had prior refractive surgery, you know, an older patient that's having, wants a multifocal lens, they've had prior refractive surgery, you know, what are you going to do for that patient? And that comes up more and more these days as our, you know, baby boomers are getting older and we're getting into the now Gen X, you know,
yeah,
category of patients.
What? Piggyback lens. That's there. Piggyback. The other thing is, obviously, once we finally have a truly accommodating lens, it solves so many issues, because for every patient, if I have five true diopters of accommodation, well, I just do the lens counts and aim for plus a half on everyone.
There you go. And that's the beauty. It would be so much more forgiving than right. what we have right now, which is, you know, why the human eye works so well. Because we have this huge accommodative amplitude as young people. So we really, you know, basically helps out all the low hyperopes. They didn't even know they were low hyperopes until they got older.
Right. All the latent hyperopes.
Right.
Yeah. It's so interesting. The other thing, let me ask another question. So since I got you, I'm going to pick your brains. I got to learn. Our audience wants to learn too. Now, one thing that I've a little bit of a challenge with, in a younger person coming in for LASIK, let's say in their 20s or 30 years old, low myope, and you see their cycloplegic refraction is significantly less than their subjective refraction. Let's say subjective refraction is minus 3, but then you cycloplegia them and they're minus 2.
Right.
Well, now what do you do?
And what's the age of the patient?
Let's say 30.
30. Yeah. For a young patient that has one diopter of difference, it's not that hard, because you will get some regression of the treatment over time. So sometimes in younger myopes, I'll actually overcorrect them because I'll plan for some regression in those patients over the next 20 years or so. Okay. So if it's only one diopter of difference between their manifest and their cyclo, in that case, you know, certainly I would try to push plus in the patient. I might even say, hey, try these contact lenses that are going to be closer to your cycloplegic and see if, you know, you can relax your accommodative sort of tone and get used to what your real prescription is. But in cases where, let's say you try that and they just can't, and they say, no, it's blurry, I like my minus 3, your cyclo is still minus 2, I might even target them. I might put into the laser minus 2.75, yeah. You know, I'll overcorrect them because I know that they'll be happy for now, and that over time they'll likely regress. Okay. It becomes a more challenging case if you have big differences, let's say 2 diopters. Let's say they were minus 1 on their cyclo and there's still -3 manifest. Now, what do you treat? Oof. And then that, yeah, in that case, you know, you can try to do even an atropine challenge for that type of patient, depending on what they're doing, like really break their accommodative tone. And if they're -1, they're going to be bothered by the light because they're going to be dilated, but they should be actually visually functional for most things, except for, you know, reading small print. So you can't do it for everybody, but sometimes there are ways to get around it. You can do, again, contact lens trial, or you can actually do like an accommodative penalization with atropine drops.
So basically for the surgeon, focus on the next 5 or 10 years for the patient and don't worry so much about the next, you know, what happens 20 years down the road.
That is my strategy all the way. Like I worry about, let's worry about the next 5 years, 10 years, and then we're going to deal with what, if you have any issues at that point, we're going to deal with them then. Because we know as refractive surgeons, being in this business for so long, that your visual needs and your visual status changes over your lifetime. So there are going to be other things that you're going to need down the road. And that's okay, because we know our technology is going to keep up pace. And that 10 years down the road, what we have to offer you at that point is going to be different, better than what we have now.
Right. I think that's important to remember. Things do change. You brought up earlier in the conversation about how astigmatism changes, how we go from, you know, with the rule to kind of against the rule. I had a patient of mine I saw recently. I did eyewall surgery 15 years ago when they were, let's say, 75. And they ended up perfectly spherical. So happy with toric lenses. And now I see the patient 15 years later. The patient is 90 years old. And the patient's got a solid diopter against the rule. That's the age of ready to change.
Yeah. Yeah. You see it. It's very interesting. I mean, does it have to do with lid position over time and like sort of mechanical pressures, dynamic pressures on the eye? Maybe. But it's very interesting. And it's fairly consistent as you look over a population-based like demographic.
Yeah, for sure. I think sometimes it's what my patients said, Doc, I have OLD syndrome. So what's that? He says, I'm old.
Exactly.
I guess it happens to the best of us.
And it's better than the alternative.
Right. That's for dang sure. Getting old is definitely better than the alternative. Now, in our last 5 minutes, we've been talking for like almost an hour. I can't believe it. What do you for fun? What do you do outside of ophthalmology?
These days, I've been playing some golf. I've been, you know, now that I'm an empty nester and my kids are, you know, have their own independent lives, I have more time. So on the weekends, I go out and try to hit some golf balls and it's really fun. I'm still pretty bad, but,
No, I hear you're an ace. You're an incredible golfer.
Not an ace, but you know, now I have some time to work on it and it's really fun. Gets me outdoors.
Yeah, I too am an empty nester, and I only play golf when my son's in town because he loves golf. And if I book a tee time, he'll spend 4 hours with the old man here.
Exactly. It's a good trap.
Because if I don't book the tee time, he'll go hang out with his friends. I won't even see him. He'll be in town, but I won't even see him. So.
That's fun stuff.
Well, Sonia, thank you so much for taking the time for this podcast. I actually learned a lot. I'm sure it's going to be super educational for all our listeners.
Thanks, Uday. It's been a pleasure to spend some time with you, and it's really nice to see you.
Likewise. And I won't tell people we've known each other for more than 20 years. I'll say like at least 2 years.
Okay. Greater than 2 years.
You look still young as ever. I look like I got beaten with the ugly stick.
No, you look like you've been at the gym. Yeah, you're in good shape.
The only thing that keeps my head clear.
Well, good for you.
I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cat and Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, and where you find a podcast, you find the Cat and Coach podcast. And of course, there's a new Cataract Coach video every single day, 2,800 something days in a row. Never miss a day, and hopefully never will. Until next time, I'll catch you later.